The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to
discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system,
improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And the Dagoba Group,
a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice
with specialties in unconscious bias,
leadership dynamics, and client engagement.
Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend.
More at thedagobagroup.com.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. On January 16th of 1920, Americans took their last legal drink for 13 years. In New York City, gadflies draped themselves in black and funeral robes in anticipation of the Volstead Act kicking off prohibition at midnight. Reporters for the Daily News imagined the last words of John Barleycorn. "I've had more friends in private and more foes in public than any other man in America." America's history with alcohol veers between those two poles, the social and the secretive, temperance and intemperance, addiction and recovery. Susan Cheever follows those cycles in a new book called Drinking in America. From the pilgrims landing on Plymouth Rock because they ran out of beer, to inebriated Revolutionary and Civil War soldiers, to writers like her father, John Cheever, who created a romantic mythology around creativity, success, and alcohol. And Susan Cheever joins us now from New York City. Susan, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
Well, right back to the origins of the country you bring us, and we learned that it was a lack of beer, at least partially responsible for the Mayflower landing at Plymouth Rock. Really, what's the story?
Well, the Mayflower was a boat that we can almost call it cursed. It had all kinds of problems. And when they made landfall on Cape Cod, they were happier than any of us can imagine. But in those days, people didn't drink the water. So beer was tremendously important to... That's what they drank instead of water. And they drank quite a lot of it. It was a gallon a day.
Wow.
Was the personal ration. And so when they started running out of beer, because the voyage had taken much longer than they thought it would, it was a real concern. And they were supposed to go. Their charter from King James was for Northern Virginia. So they knew what Cape Cod was. They recognized it. And they knew they shouldn't land there. They knew they needed to get south and go to Northern Virginia, but they were running out of beer. And both they were concerned about what would happen when they landed, and Captain Jones was concerned about getting the Mayflower back to England and having enough beer for his crew. As it turned out, he didn't make it back to England until the next year anyway, but it was a real concern, and it was one of the principal reasons why they landed on Cape Cod.
It's so funny because I tend to think of early America as this kind of rigidly pious, sober, puritanical place. But you paint a portrait of everyone basically walking around kind of drunk.
Well, when you drink beer instead of water, that contributes to, let's say, your overall demeanor, right? But it isn't just the pilgrims. What amazed me, I mean, I knew about the pilgrims, but what amazed me as I researched the book was over and over and over again, American history has been shaped by somebody's drinking. I had no idea that Senator Joe McCarthy and that whole Red Scare thing, I had no idea that he was drunk. Finding those kinds of things out made writing this book so exciting. I had no idea that Paul Revere stopped on his ride for a couple of drinks at Isaac Hall's Tavern. I didn't know, I mean, to zoom back and forth in the centuries, I didn't know that the Secret Service agents in the car behind the Kennedys in the Dallas motorcade had been out till 2, 3, 4, 5 in the morning. So I began to find things out that showed me this kind of other way of looking at history.
Well, it was amazing. That was fascinating to me as well, especially this kind of idea that there's this split into two factions in American history that continue to play out. You know, that we have, I think you write, the drunkest nation in the world alternating with the most
right.
sober nation in the world.
Well, it's definitely who we are when it comes to alcohol. You know, other nations drink more, other nations drink less, but no other nation is one of the drunkest countries in the world and then 100 years later outlaws it. So we have the most passionate ambivalence about drinking of any nation in the world. And again, it's really shaped who we are and continues to shape who we are. One of the reasons I wanted to write the book was that I think we're going back towards some kind of prohibition, and I wanted to make the point that that didn't really work. And, you know, the whole question of can you legislate addiction is an endlessly interesting question. And I don't have the answer to it, but clearly that attempt, prohibition, to legislate addiction didn't work.
Well, I'd love to dig into this drunk and sober nation by the 18th century. This is after the Pilgrims. The American colonies were known, not for the least of which, for their drunkenness. And so what is this? Is it sort of like no one's looking anymore? It's like kids, you know, just first released into their college dorm so they get to drink all they want?
Well, no. I think a number of things came together to make us, in the 1820s and 30s, one of the drunkest countries in the world. I think it was availability. I think, again, people didn't like to drink water, but it was amazing how much we drank. I mean, kids at breakfast drank something called Flip, which was fruit juice and grain alcohol, before they went to school, which I'm sure made school a lot more bearable. Farmers had a bottle at the end of every row so that when they were reaping, they could have a shot at the end of every row. It was really a huge, I don't want to call it a problem, but many, many people were drunk. And one of the things that changed that, of course, was the Industrial Revolution. In other words, if you make a mistake when you're planting corn because you're drunk, it's not so terrible. But when you make a mistake in a factory, there are many more severe consequences. So that was one of the things that caused us to start pulling back on how much we drank.
But what is it about the American spirit? You write about the history of the taverns of the colonial era became the cradle of the American Revolution. You know, rum was very cheap. Was it just having a place, or is there something essential to drinking that somehow emboldened this fledgling independent spirit of Americans? You know, that kind of Dutch
Absolutely.
Courage, we can get that king kind of thing.
Well, it's more than Dutch courage. I think it's actually, you know, there are actually characteristics of people who drink, whether or not they're alcoholics, that are fairly universal. And one of them is defiance. One of them is a passion for justice. One of them is, and you know, the Sons of Liberty met in the Green Dragon Tavern. So I certainly think that the drinking that was being done by the men who were planning the revolution and taking the actions that caused the revolution had a huge effect on the fact that the revolution happened.
Mm. Well, you had these figures like Ethan Allen, who took Fort
right.
Ticonderoga when he was drinking, Ulysses S. Grant, the Civil War binge drinker.
Well, but these guys were heroes.
Right. And so are these traits that are common to the alcoholic also things that
absolutely.
Make them heroic?
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, it's not all bad drinking in America by any means. I mean, Ethan Allen is a good example. His capture of Fort Ticonderoga and, you know, the subsequent taking of the cannons from Ticonderoga to Bunker Hill, which is why the Battle of Bunker Hill came out the way it did, it was insane, you know? I mean, half of his men didn't show up. With a handful of men, the door to the fort was supposed to be open and it was closed. But he just marched right in there. He was a little drunk and marched right into the head of the fort and said, "Give it up." And it's certainly being drunk, as Ethan Allen often was, I'm sure helped him pull that off, which helped us win the revolution.
Well, some of these moves were a little more strategic. George Washington, he made sure he doubled the rum rations during the rough winter at Valley Forge.
Exactly. I mean, George Washington, I don't think, was a drunk, although the biggest business in the country was his whiskey distillery for a while. But he said, I would never send men into battle unless they were moderately drunk.
Hmm. Well, you mentioned his rum distillery. I mean, the book really points to not only the social, but the economic history, like profits from alcohol fueling American industry and American dynasties. How is this all tied together?
Well, it's very interesting about the money, especially when you look at both Alexander Hamilton and then the lead up to Prohibition. Hamilton hated drinking, had a terrible experience as a child because his father was a drunk and thought it was disgusting. And so Hamilton really thought that it was okay to tax alcohol in an almost unlimited way. He thought that the federal government should be paid for by alcohol taxes. And that really happened. I mean, that was one of the reasons why Prohibition couldn't happen until we passed a personal income tax. Because until we passed a personal income tax, and I think that's in 1914, there was no other way to finance the federal government except liquor taxes. So that's kind of fascinating that our feelings about liquor actually made a huge difference in how we taxed it.
We're continuing our conversation with Susan Cheever, author of Drinking in America. We were talking before the break about the complicated relationship this country has always had with alcohol. From the initial landing on Plymouth Rock because the Mayflower ran out of beer, to alcohol as a means of growing the economy.
I mean, that was one of the reasons why Prohibition couldn't happen until we passed a personal income tax. Because until we passed a personal income tax, there was no other way to finance the federal government.
The dark underbelly of America's fiscal reliance on alcohol is addiction. Alexander Hamilton embodied the nation's conflicted regard of drinking as gift of the gods or curse of the devil. He was the son of an alcoholic. He hated drinking and was one of many prominent Americans who fiercely adopted abstinence as a moral stance in reaction to growing up around drunkenness. Today, 12-step groups and many doctors regard alcoholism as a disease, and maybe even as the result of a genetic predisposition. Well, even in colonial America, when diseases were treated with leeches and folk remedies, there was some progressive notion of alcoholism as a disease. So, Susan Cheever, what can you tell us about the evolution of the concept of alcoholism?
I think you were just referring to Dr. Benjamin Rush,
right,
who was basically the doctor for the Continental Congress, Franklin's doctor, Jefferson's doctor, the Adams's doctor. And he believed that alcoholism was a disease, and he believed that it had a genetic component. The trouble with Benjamin Rush is he would be a complete hero, a sort of Galileo of alcoholism, except that he also believed in something that he called spontaneous combustion. And he thought if you got too drunk and stood next to a fire and burped, for instance, you would blow up. And so there was a little, I don't want to say craziness, but a little exaggeration mixed in with his incredibly prescient wisdom. And I think, I do think it, you know, some of his ideas were so far out that this idea that alcoholism is a disease seemed equally far out to some people. The sad part of it is that John Adams's family is a tragically classic alcoholic family. Two of John Adams's sons died of alcoholism in their 30s, and two of his grandsons. So John Quincy Adams lost two brothers and two sons to drinking. But the things that Benjamin Rush could have taught the Adamses, were he a little more or a little less out there, might have really helped them. It's such a sad story, that family.
Yeah, it's tragic in the book, but at the same time, the sort of image of the temperance movement that we so often get is, you know, the lips pursed, the finger wagging image.
Oh, no. The temperance guys were great.
It's really illuminating here. But that's the thing. I think we've been looking at history, the history of drinking in America, in very broad strokes, which you give it a very different face. The individual stories, which is part of the story of what is called the Washingtonians. This is in the 1820s.
The Washingtonians.
Kind of revolutionary.
The temperance movement is so interesting. Many of the women who ended up getting the vote for women in 1920 started as temperance crusaders, found they weren't allowed to speak to audiences of men, and decided that the vote was more important. But, you know, my favorite is Phineas T. Barnum, who was a great crusader, and the sideshow of the circus was this play called The Drunkard, which, of course, was a moral tale about how bad it is to drink. And he was a real thumper, Phineas T. Barnum, and he was a temperance crusader. He actually offered, he came to New York City and offered to pay for the education and housing of everyone in the city if they would close the bars. And, of course, they weren't interested. And then when he met John Bailey was also not a drinker. And so the circus, the Barnum and Bailey Circus, was a sober outfit, which, of course, makes perfect sense. You know, I wanted to go back for a second to talking about people like Hamilton or John Quincy Adams, the people who aren't alcoholic and become and get caught up in temperance, because we have such a good example of that right now in Donald Trump. Hmm. Donald Trump saw his beloved brother die of alcoholism, his older brother who he adored, and he doesn't drink and he hates drinking in that same way that you often see when somebody sees what drinking will cost, when somebody pays that cost personally, and then they just turn on it. So it's something that's still happening, and I don't think we understand it very well. But, my observation is that when people are able to do that, when people lose people they adore to alcoholism, and then they are able to stop drinking, they get the idea that they have tremendous control. They get the idea that they are really in charge of their own fate. And it makes them a certain kind of person. I just see a lot of John Quincy Adams in Donald Trump.
Mm, so interesting. Wyatt Earp is someone else you write about in that way.
Exactly.
General George Custer. What about your relationship with this? You written again about your father's alcoholism, how it affected your family. And now you're writing about a country, you know, its relationship to alcohol as essential, you say, as churches and preachers and election and politics. But I don't get any judgment from you. I don't get any of that sort of, you know, my father was an alcoholic and disorderly, so therefore everything should be more orderly.
Well, listen, my father was an alcoholic who wrote more beautifully than most people. No, I have no judgment. I think that I'm very, very interested in American history. I've written 3 books of American history, and I'm very, very interested in alcoholism and how it works. And these two interests came together with this kind of explosion in this book. It's sort of, in that way, a book that I was born to write, a book that just brings together everything that fascinates me. But I certainly don't judge. I mean, how can you judge someone like Ulysses S. Grant? He won the Civil War for us. And, you know, I don't think alcoholics are bad. I think they're alcoholics.
Susan Cheever, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Susan Cheever is an author of several books, including most recently Drinking in America, Our Secret History. You can find more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The human fascination with flight is as old as cave paintings of birds and as natural as a baby's laugh when being tossed up in the air. The wish to soar sent the arrogant Icarus toppling into the sea in the ancient Greek myth. Today, hang gliding, skydiving, and riding zip lines has allowed millions of people to experience the adrenaline-fueled feeling of flight, with some safeguards. For those with more extreme tastes, the sport of wingsuit racing is gaining ground. Looking like Batman or giant flying squirrels, wingsuit enthusiasts fly thousands of feet in the air at speeds up to 200 miles per hour. Alex Davies covers transportation at Wired, where he wrote about a national wingsuit competition and profiled an aspiring champ. Alex, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So up to 200 miles an hour, what is a body doing at that speed?
Well, the face is pretty much flapping like a sail in the wind. But the flyer I spoke to, is a guy named Joe Ridler, describes part of it as physically excruciating because they're flying in these wingsuits. And it's not just about trying to get to the ground safely, it's about going as fast as you can and as far as you can, and that means extending your arms and your legs and your core as far out as you possibly can in the wingsuit, and that's basically the toughest core workout you've ever had, going at 200 miles an hour through the air.
I can barely imagine it. I mean, obviously the appeal of flying, but that does sound kind of excruciating.
Yeah, and I think the people who get into this are people who have been skydiving for a long time, and actually the U.S. Parachute Association won't let anybody fly with a wingsuit until they've had at least 200 jumps out of an airplane with a traditional parachute. So the people who are into this are people who really love skydiving and who are, at a certain point, probably looking for a new kind of challenge.
Describe the wingsuits. What makes them first so adept at reaching such high speeds?
So it's basically like making yourself into a flying squirrel. You know, it's made out of fabric. It covers your entire body. And basically, it gives you flapped arms, you know, webbed arms and a big web between your legs. One of the big differences here is between people who base jump with wingsuits and what these competitions are about, which are jumping out of a plane. Base jumping is when you're jumping off of a cliff or a bridge wearing one of these suits, and it's generally considered very dangerous because you're flying around obstacles, so there are things to hit. These guys are jumping out of a plane at thousands of feet up where there's nothing below them to hit. And at about 3,000 feet in the air, they're going to pull their parachute and float down to safety.
The first ever championships in wingsuit racing were held at the beginning of October. Now, this is in Illinois. What is the sport here, Alex? I mean, what kinds of conditioning or athleticism are necessary to win? Can you actually navigate?
Yeah, so you actually can navigate. And a lot of what practice runs are all about is learning how exactly to make your suit do what you want it to do. So the championships require that each jumper compete in three disciplines, which are basically how fast you can go, how far you can go, and how much time you can spend in the air. And they're measuring all of that in a window of about 3,000 meters up to 2,000 meters up. So basically, how horizontal can you make your flight as opposed to vertical, the way anyone less experienced would fall? And so each time these guys go up and then fly down, they're doing what Joe Ridler, who I spoke with, calls little scientific experiments. He said, okay, this jump I'm going to tuck my toes in a little bit more, or I'm going to stick my chin out half an inch more and see how drastically that affects the flight.
And did it?
Yeah, and he said each one, you know, if you're going for distance, it's a little bit different than if you're going for time. So each of those little things makes a big difference because you're going so fast, and it's like if you punched a small hole in an airplane wing, you'd get drastic differences. And you're doing the same kind of thing here, except you yourself are the sail.
We're talking about something that is just spectacular to watch. I mean, I've watched a couple videos of it. What was your impression watching? Your heart in your throat? After having spoken with Joe, what were you thinking about might be going through his mind?
Yeah, well, I think The most amazing thing he told me is he said, you know, like, I was afraid of heights as a kid, and I'm still a little afraid of heights. And I was like, what? Really? Like, and this is what you do? And I think he said, like, it's just so, you know, it's obviously scary, and I think it gets less scary as you get into it, especially as you start focusing on competition and you think less about, am I going to survive this, and more about, how can I win? How can I go faster than the other guys who are in the air at the same time as you? Joe also told me that when he's on the ground, he does a lot of yoga, he does a lot of meditation, and these are things that let you keep your focus when you're moving at that speed and really need to keep your mind sharp.
Alex Davies, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Alex Davies, he's in charge of all things transportation for Wired. That's where we read his article, The Excruciating 200 Miles Per Hour World of Wingsuit Racing. You can find more, including a link to read his article and some videos, at wordofmouthradio.org. While some types of outdoor adventures involve traveling at high speeds, ending in a matter of seconds, others are painfully slow and take years to accomplish. Mark Bramhill has the story of one such adventurer, a woman named Sarah Oten, who knows what it's like to cross an ocean row by row by row.
You know, from land I might be over 1,000 miles plus. There might be shipping traffic about, but I never see those people. I rarely speak to them. I tend to wake up with the first light, have something to eat, check where I am, check what's going on with the weather, get outside and start rowing. On a clear day in the middle of the ocean when the sea is flat and calm, maybe mirror-like, and the sky is bright blue, it's a very peaceful place to be. Beguiling, almost. Just bewitching. And it feels like a good day when it's a day like that.
Sarah Oten is on a journey, circumnavigating the globe using only human power. It's a solo trip, traveling from London to London by bike, kayak, and rowboat. Right now, she's preparing for the final leg, rowing from Cape Cod to the UK. To most of us, this sounds insane. But in college, rowing was Sarah's life. And when she first heard about ocean rowing, she knew she wanted to do it herself.
Sometimes you see something and you have a sense that you're going to love it and you're going to thrive off it. But I loved the ocean and I loved rowing. And, you know, I knew that I would be challenged by it as well, massively. It's still an ocean, but other people have done it. It's not rocket science, and therefore if they can do it, well, I should be able to do it.
Sarah began her adventure 4 years ago in 2011. First, she kayaked from London to France. Then she biked across Europe, pedaling day after day. After Europe, she had to cross Asia, including the oppressively hot Gobi Desert. More pedaling. Then she had to kayak to Japan. Up to this point, all had gone surprisingly well. But then she was going to go up against the Pacific, the most difficult leg of her trip. Before we get into it, though, you need a little background on Sarah's journey. She set out when she was 24, traveling using her bike, named Hercules, and her kayak, named Nelson. But you've seen bikes and kayaks. What's unusual is her rowboat, Gulliver. It's 21 feet long, with two watertight compartments, one at the front for storing extra oars or her satellite phone, and one at the back for sleeping. These captain's quarters are small. Sarah says it's like sitting under the kitchen table. And the boat weighs a ton, a literal 2,000 pounds. After spending the winter in Japan, Sarah was ready to face the Pacific. In May of 2012, she got into her boat and headed east. But 600 miles off the coast of Japan, she got some bad news.
About 3 weeks in, my weather router Lee sent me a message telling me about this forthcoming typhoon, which was brewing off the Philippines and was going to be in my area in about a week's time.
A strong typhoon is just off
typhoon
the coast.
Mawar.
Gusty winds, rough surf.
And typhoon Mawar was headed straight for Sarah. The storm was bad. 85-mile-per-hour winds, waves of over 50 feet. But it was looking like it might die down before it reached her. So Sarah's weatherman told her she had two choices.
One is to get picked up by a container ship. The other is to wait and see what happens. You know, it might change, divert course, etc. I decided that I would stay.
most frightening conditions I've ever been in. Capsizing. 32 hours. Took a real beating at the hands of the merciless tropical storm. It all seemed to be a lot stronger than we'd originally thought it might be.
Sarah was rescued by the Japanese Coast Guard after 3 days in the storm, but she had to leave her boat Gulliver behind. She returned home to England to recover, both physically and psychologically.
I came home having experienced something pretty horrific by myself. Lost my boat, which was everything. It's everything to you when you're by yourself. And it all happened so suddenly. And then you come home to the context of quote-unquote normal life and people expecting you to be happy and bouncy, etc. And actually all of that trauma and adrenaline just kind of spread itself out over everything in my life, such that I ended up not really being able to function at all. You know, just any small task, I would burst into tears. I really struggled.
And then, at the darkest point of her depression, she got lucky. Really lucky.
In January 2013, 7 months after I'd come back, totally not expecting to find love. So it was by surprise through a mutual friend that Lucy and I met and very quickly became very keen on each other. And I said, so I'm going away rowing in just a couple of months' time, and I'm going to be away for 18 months. How do you feel about that? And amazingly, Lucy was very supportive of it, and we decided to stay together. We'd been totally besotted with each other.
A few months into a relationship, most people wouldn't want to be separated for even a few days, let alone 18 months. They would give up trying to loop the globe and stay home. Half the world is good enough for most of us. But not Sarah. For her, quitting just wasn't an option. So she got a new boat called Happy Socks, identical to the one she had lost. She said goodbye to Lucy, flew back to Japan, and set off again to finish the Pacific. And with that came the trials of rowing solo.
On a good day, I might travel 70 plus nautical miles. On a bad day, I might get blown backwards 50 miles, something like that. So it's really, it can be quite frustrating.
And now these setbacks were even worse. Every day pushed backwards was another day away from Lucy.
The times alone are often beautiful, but there's times when I would really like somebody else to be there on the rowing sections. I'd love someone to be there in the really scary moments. And certainly for me, since meeting Lucy, I don't want to be alone. You know, if she could be out there on the boat, well, that would make it even better.
Lucy couldn't be in the boat with Sarah, but they talked on the satellite phone. They talked on. And then one day, Sarah worked up the courage to propose from the middle of the Pacific.
I hadn't planned on asking her. Then I just thought, well, why should I wait till the other side? Why should I wait till she's here for me to ask the question? And so I called her up one day on the satellite phone, and she said yes.
Then how did you bring it up on a phone call?
Oh, I just called her up and jumped straight in with a question. There's no point dilly-dallying around these things. I left the buying of the engagement rings to Lucy. She bought them and got them engraved. And meanwhile, out on the Pacific Ocean, I took a permanent marker and drew it across my finger and kept redrawing it when it got washed off.
Sarah has changed a lot over the course of her journey. She set off a solo adventure, one woman against the world. But now, Sarah no longer wants to go it alone. She's ready for something that might be even more complicated than circumnavigating the globe, raising a family with Lucy. But she's not home yet. Once she finished crossing the Pacific, she was joined by Lucy to bike east across the U.S. and Canada. She arrived in Chatham on Cape Cod and prepared to row across the Atlantic. The water is flat, the wind is calm. It's time to leave. Crowds of people have gathered to wish Sarah goodbye. Friends, acquaintances, total strangers. And Lucy, holding up a sign that says, "See you on the other side. I love you." Sarah gets into her boat, she pushes off from the dock, and she rows. Until the cheering fades away. until Lucy's sign disappears over the horizon. She'll row and row and row and row. From Chatham, Massachusetts, I'm Mark Bramhill.
And that story was produced this spring. We have a quick update on Sarah's journey. In early October, after 140 days on the Atlantic, the tail end of Hurricane Joaquin forced Sarah to curtail her trip. Sadly, her second rowboat, Happy Socks, was left behind. After spending some time recuperating in Montreal, Sarah says she is not going to attempt another crossing and is instead preparing to wrap up the last bit of her journey, a bike ride from the coast of England to her home in London. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. If your image of dinosaurs was formed in elementary school, it's probably out of date. All those illustrations and models with grayish, brownish, scaly, leathery skin could be completely wrong. We have fossils and forensics to envision the shape and scale of dinosaurs, but no remaining samples of skin. We only recently learned that many dinosaurs had feathers, and now scientists are finding clues about another feature that until now we've just had to imagine: color. Caitlin Kaliri is a paleontology PhD student at Virginia Tech, where she's studying the preservation and degradation of biomolecules. She's lead author on a recent study exploring diagenetically altered melanin in exceptionally preserved fossils, or what color dinosaurs really were. Caitlin, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, that's a mouthful I've just gone through, beginning with diagenetically altered melanin. Now, what does that mean and what does it tell us about color?
Well, melanin is the pigment that we find in pretty much every hair color you can imagine. So black, brown, blonde, gray, and red. And there are two different types of melanin. There's eumelanin and there's pheomelanin. Eumelanin is a black pigment and pheomelanin is a red pigment. And we find traces of altered melanin in these fossils that we were studying, which allows us to tell you what color they were.
So that would mean the melanin that sort of decomposed onto the fossils, or do you actually have remnants of skin?
Well, we find these fossils that are exceptionally preserved. So they do preserve skin, and more importantly for this study, they preserved feathers and they preserved fur or hair. So that's what we were looking at. And you actually find preserved in the feather and the hair these structures called melanosomes. And melanosomes are the organelles that contain melanin, and they're preserved in the fossils, and we find melanin preserved in conjunction with those structures.
So what does that preserved melanin reveal?
Well, biologists know a lot about what animals do based on what color they are. So we can now, by looking at color, make inferences regarding what sort of environment they lived in, how they protect themselves, and how they communicate with one another. So we can really get a better picture of what animals looked like that are no longer around.
How precise is that picture?
Well, it's getting even more precise now that we have these methods of looking at color. And I think that it'll continue to improve now that we have these ways of looking at it. But looking at melanin, you only get a range of the colors that you see in hair. So there's another way of finding color, which is structural color. And this method doesn't really cover that, although we found that melanosomes are preserved in the shape and the pattern that you would expect them to be preserved in like iridescent feathers, for example. So we're getting a better idea of what structural color could tell us about from the fossil record as well.
So you say range of color. So I'm curious if you can give us some kind of comparative color combinations for dinosaur skins or outer layers that you've discovered.
Well, we were looking at a lot of different animals, and the fossils that we looked at, the two bats that we described their color, have been getting a lot of attention. So they're these two bats that are about 50 million years old. And by looking at their fur that was preserved, we found that they were brown, which is sort of what you would expect. But just the fact that we can get this information from a fossil is really quite extraordinary still.
What kind of conditions need to be present for these molecules to be preserved?
It's not common in the fossil record to find this type of preservation. That's why they call it exceptional preservation. And it depends, but it's definitely something that isn't the norm.
All right, so brown for this bat makes sense for me, as you said. But, you know, can we imagine, I don't know, zebra prints, Barney purple on dinosaurs?
Well, we can definitely use these methods to look at color patterns as well. So that's something that we'll be hopefully doing in the future when it comes to looking at fossil color, is looking at how animals were patterned. But like I said, we can't detect Barney purple, and I don't know that I would really expect that from dinosaurs.
It's not a lot of grape-colored species out there, are there?
No, not that I can think of, no.
Well, so how are these more recent renderings of dinosaurs different than the ones that you might have learned about when you were a kid, or different than the big models at the Natural History or Science Museum?
I think feathers are the main difference, really. When I was a kid, dinosaurs were portrayed as these big, lumbering, brown and green, scaly creatures. And now that we know, and now that we find dinosaurs preserved with feathers, that's really changed a lot of how I perceive them and how a lot of people do. And it's really great for this method also, because you find these melanosomes preserved in feathers. So it really will help us determine the colors of dinosaurs even better.
So more like giant birds than giant lizards.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, think of an ostrich.
Well, paleontologists, that's a pretty specific kind of field. I mean, you have to really know what you're going for. How did you end up in this field?
It was actually a bit of a windy road. My mother swears that I was leading expeditions in my backyard when I was 3 years old. But I wasn't one of those kids that was really excited about dinosaurs. It didn't happen until a lot later for me. And I studied anthropology for my undergrad, because I was just interested in evolution in general. And then I went on a field trip during my undergrad to the La Brea Tar Pits, and that got me started thinking about paleontology. And then I was lucky enough to go out on two field expeditions once I graduated with the Los Angeles Museum of Natural History. And we went out to Utah and we dug up dinosaurs, and that was it for me, really.
Your research is kind of a breakthrough in the way that we understand how dinosaurs looked. You know, now they have feathers. They could be of very different colors than we imagined. Is the science of figuring out what dinosaurs look like just getting better, or is it just building upon itself?
Well, I think that as technology improves, we're really able to extract information from the fossil record that we didn't even know was there. So that's something that I'm personally really excited about. And we have to remember that, you know, dinosaurs, extinct animals, aren't just these stone statues that decorate museums. We're actually able to extract biological information from them, which help us reconstruct the environments that they lived in and what their lives were like. So it's really exciting.
Well, Caitlin, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Caitlin Kaliri, she's a PhD student at Virginia Tech, and she's lead author of a recent study exploring diagenetically altered melanin in exceptionally preserved fossils. English for that would be what color dinosaurs were. You can find more on that study at wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you so much for listening today. Much more to hear at wordofmouthradio.org. And if you missed any of the show, you can catch it in its entirety with the Word of Mouth podcast. You can subscribe at wordofmouthradio.org or by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, please tell a friend and write a review. It really does help others to find us. And as we know, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, inviting you back for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 here on New Hampshire Public Radio.